have to wear him a new coat because you know he's here. We have an interesting subject this morning that comes to our attention frequently. Nearly every mail brings a request for an introduction to a reputable religious teacher. People want to know where to go, who to find, what to join, and what not to join. These letters come in constantly, and also phone messages and personal requests. As you probably realize, our organization does not carry on that aspect of the situation. We do not endorse and we do not support any particular individuals or groups. And the support for this point, I think we all need to understand rather carefully. In our search for realities, we have to depend upon some rules, some pattern of plans, purposes, requirements. And fortunately, there are such rules. And they are the same in all parts of the world. The teachings of the Arhats of China and the Adepts of Europe, the alchemists, the Gnostics, all of these different groups, the esoteric sections in all cases are the same in principle, and very largely the same in practices, for the simple reason that, like the science of medicine, wherever you are, if you have a certain ailment, you have to take the remedy that is indicated. And anyone seeking truth must follow the path, must follow the ancient, eternal, unchangeable way, because it has to do largely, in fact, completely, with the individual himself. In the adept tradition in Europe, we have the alchemistical disciplines, the series of processes which lead to the transmutations of base metals, these metals being represented by the planets and by the chemical formulas that are found in the ancient alchemical manuscripts. In the Asiatic side, in Buddhism, or Taoism, Confucianism, Hinduism, we find also that arhatship or adeptship is the result of a specialized discipline. It is a process dependent for its success upon the individual himself. In the Eastern and Western systems, we have the human personality divided into four distinct levels. These levels manifest in our physical life as faculties, powers, functions. The lowest of the levels is the physical. Above that is the energy field. Above that is the emotional sphere. And beyond that, in turn, is the mental. These constitute a ladder of four rungs up which the neophyte must climb in order to reach the higher atmosphere, which is the quintessence of the alchemist, the pure buddhi of Buddhist philosophy, the symbol of perfect enlightenment. Now, in order to understand this, we must also realize that no one can grow for anyone else. There is no possibility of shifting the responsibility of growth upon a teacher, upon a formula in the ordinary sense, or upon any group of factors. Growth is simply a process of growing. Now, we are all, as non-initiated souls, like children passing gradually from adolescence to maturity. The great teachers of the past instructed us. They were our ancestral guides. Now we must start out on our own. And one of the problems that we face in the present generation is this matter of trying to help young people to go out on their own. First of all, they are going to anyway, because parental influence is no longer strong enough to hold them. You can teach them whatever you want to, but in the long run, most of them will do what they intend to do. Maybe some of them will have difficult experiences and will have to grow through suffering. Others find themselves more independently and become highly desirable citizens. but each has to find its own way by means of the characteristics, the basic integrities with which it is endowed. So when we start to work with the problem of teaching, to try to find a teacher, we know that all a teacher can do is to tell the individual to do certain things. He cannot make anyone do these things. And he can only say, if you wish a certain result, you must be set in motion the causes which will result in that effect. If you are not willing to cause it, you cannot have it. No one else can have it for you. The gods will not bestow it. Each individual must earn his own destiny, must fulfill the plan for which he was intended, as part of a system that has as its objective the enlightenment of everything that lives. This enlightenment, however, is a completely individual responsibility. Now, it is possible for a person to become inspired by association with desirable types of thinkers and believers, the meeting of the individual with other persons of high resolve, high intention, noble experience in life, all these things are objective helps, but they do not contribute the actual substance. All they can possibly do is inspire. This is all any teacher can do, is to inspire the individual to do his own job. And anyone promising other than that should be approached with due caution because of the fact that though most people are looking for someone to give them a painless solution for the mysteries and miseries of existence. We want to do mostly what we please, but we want to find a way of doing it and escape the consequences of our mistakes. This is just not possible. And no matter how much is claimed, the fact remains that each individual must live out his own pattern of purposes. There are rough instructions, however, and some of them are pretty rough, as to how this is done. One of the first is to realize this set of four steps, and to realize that the life of sanctity begins at the bottom of these steps and ascends gradually. And in the Eastern system, in the system of the yoga and the arhats and the lohans of China, the Taoist system, and also the Muslim mysticism, the simple fact is that all growth begins with the proper development and integrity of the physical body. The physical body must become the pedestal or base upon which the project is situated or fixed. So the aspirant begins by considering the means by means of which the physical body can be brought into the closest possible relationship with normalcy and harmony. This means that any destructive habit which endangers the body blocks the entire procedure. The individual cannot go along and have a little marijuana now and then and accomplish the things he wants to accomplish. It's not possible. The physical body must come first. Now, your ascetics, even in the Old Testament and in most of religions, went out into the wilderness and there meditated and prayed in solitude. We have a wilderness also, but it's called chaos. It's where we live now, and if anything could be more a wilderness, we don't know. This is what the Muslim calls the desert of waiting. The place where everything now lacks the quietude that we associate with the deserts, the mountains, and the valleys. Therefore, we cannot really go away and simply devote our lives to that kind of physical therapy. Naturally, if we could get out of the city, get away from the smog, get rid of our debtors, all these things, it would help. But most persons are not willing to make such sacrifices. So the physical problem has to be solved as it is in Mahayana Buddhism, not by going into the desert and meditating and praying, but facing each day with an increasing degree of internal enlightenment. In other words, the physical world must be conquered in the person. He must find ways of living in this material existence without being damaged by it. Now, this is hard to think about because almost anything we do will damage us. But the thing that damages us most is when we have to do what we do not want to do. Therefore, the beginning of the correction is to stop not wanting to do that which is necessary. We can avoid certain pitfalls by not setting the causes in motion. We can keep the body in the best condition as long as we can by moderate living. We can also make sure that it has proper ventilation, proper nutrition, and has opportunities for peace, quietude, and sleep. One of the things that the old systems always point out is the importance of keeping away from artificial drugs to produce the effects that are desired. It cannot be entirely followed, but we should not attempt to bring the body under control by doping it. It has to be done by the intelligence of the individual who is the caretaker of that body and is therefore responsible for its functions. He must decide that the body is a younger brother to the mind and that it is the duty of the elder brother to guard and protect the younger brother. It is the duty of the individual never to neglect the physical requirements of living, but never to accept the extravagances which come from lack of insight. The great life, the enlightened life, must be normal, but it must also be simple. A simple and direct life. Extravagance has a tendency to damage the body as well as the rest of the organism. The process of living in this body only to use it for the fulfillment of self-centered ambitions and purposes is wrong. The body is the servant of an individual who presumably knows what he's doing. And if the person doesn't know, the body cannot follow the leadership. And without leadership, the body falls apart. So the beginning of the road that leads to enlightenment is to settle down quietly and take whatever time is necessary to make a friend of the body for the first time, perhaps, in our lives. Make the body a valuable and important member of our personal collective. Give the body its rights and its dues. Do not dissipate it. Do not damage it. Do not exhaust it on useless enterprises. The body is willing to be martyred to a great purpose, but never to a small one. Therefore, the body must be considered first. This means a gradual modification of many attitudes that we have. Luxuries may be more damaging to the body than they are of use, but the body endures them because the mind or the emotions wants them. And wherever the mind and the emotions lead the body to excess, there is damage. This must be carefully watched and regulated, or we will get into trouble. Now, beyond the body comes the second area, which only is workable, usable, and possible if the body has already been brought into order. We must ascend, always building upon a solid foundation. Until we have solved the lower, we cannot pass to something higher. Assuming we have regulated the body, that we have given it all that it needs, but never for a moment sacrificed its well-being for some other purpose of our own, unless that sacrifice is justified by moral expediency, by the need to give something beyond our normal. The individual who gives their life to save another life has not disfigured the body. They have given it to a purpose that is higher. That which is higher is always the basis of the realities and the right values of things. But assuming that we now live simply, that we are not subject to extravagances, that we are not dissipated, and that the body is not disturbed by any external situation, that the body is not working for something, not working for something that is worthwhile, that it is supporting an extravagance of the mind and not the need of its own integrities. So the body being settled, we pass to the second level, assuming that the body has now been disciplined as the first step of discipleship. The energy fields or vital body, etheric double of the physical, is the source of our supply of life force. It is that which animates all things and makes them alive. This aliveness is primarily turned downward. It is the aliveness, the vitality, which protects the body and makes it capable of receiving into itself stress and strain from higher causes within its own structure. Now, the vital body, being an energy field, the individual who wishes to advance in spiritual matters must reduce energy pressures. They must not waste energy, because energy is life, and life is the power of God in us. Therefore, energy must be conserved. Energy must be distributed properly. We come almost under a heading of physical culture here. We have to see that the energy field is given ample opportunity to express itself constructively, but that any intemperance which wastes energy becomes a leakage in the energy field. And through this leakage, it escapes and is not available for reasonable purposes. Energy, to be maintained, must have proper nutrition. It must have proper rest and relaxation. It must be energized by a physical body that is temperate and therefore does not waste or destroy energy. Energy cannot live unless the physical body is reasonably ordered. If it is reasonably ordered, then it can provide a proper footing for energy growth. But if the individual suddenly gets into a temper fit, the waste of energy damages both the vital body and the physical. The individual in hysteria, the person who is constantly neurotic, the individual who starts worshiping energy waste, doing things that are not significant and not important. All energy is to be used for constructive purposes, in order that energy, which is life, a part of which has been given to us, will be used as it was intended to be used, for the greater good of all that lives. All energy which has not some justification in value becomes a dangerous factor in our composition. So energy enables us to do all kinds of useful things. It also will support us in extreme hardships on many cases. But it cannot stand or survive misdirection from below or wrong attention from above. It must be given the care and discipline necessary. Energy discipline involves one important factor, quietude. Quietude means that the human body must at certain times rest. If the energy does not remove its pressures from the body, then the body cannot rest, and the least we can expect is fidgets, and they are no good either. The individual who can't sit still, who can't keep quiet, who finds it impossible to do simple things in a simple and efficient manner, the individual has to exaggerate all actions, and finding themselves highly nervous, must take a sedation. This type of thing is deadly to the development of any higher faculties. If the individual wishes to remain on the level in which these things are done, he has the right. No one can take it from him. But if he wants to be better than he is now, he must correct the mistakes that burden him now. He must have motives, purposes, and ideals stronger and better than those which he has been nursing in the past. So he does everything possible to use energy wisely. He may feel that it is an eternal factor, that he will always have it, but he will find that this is a mistake. If he wastes it, he will not always have it. The body is itself a fallible thing, and to make it useful, helpful, and constructive as long as possible, its essential resources must be conserved. One of the physical forces and sources of energy is nutrition. So this comes into this pattern. Proper nutrition. Nutrition that is not fatty, to nutrition that is based upon, as far as possible, a full understanding of the requirements of the body and its nervous structure. Nutrition is very important because without it, the individual has no foundation upon which to build. Therefore, the first problem is to get the body into physical condition that is suitable to become a living temple. And the second step of the problem is to create within this living temple an atmosphere of divine presence, the energy being the presence of the infinite within the structure of the finite. This, and then, if it is accomplished, if the individual finds that he is able to make these corrections and never waste energy, wasting energy can be simply the support of a poor cause. It can be talking too much when there's nothing to say. It can be almost anything. On the other hand, the loss of these wastefulness factors should never result in a dourful personality. The energy factors that are constructive are pleasant, more pleasant in the long run than those which cause trouble. But then we rise to the third level, and this is a rough one. One of the most difficult to face, and not to be faced at all, unless the lower two have already been conquered. You cannot advance unless you're on the solid foundation of what goes before. Otherwise, you're in trouble. The energy factor we have to have, and one of the great uses of energy, of course, is emotion. Now, the emotional factor is where, in most cases, the human being is oriented. He lives in a combination of vital, emotional, and physical factors. And as long as this continues, he is basically a biped, but still not raised to human estate. The energy fields that involve emotion must be cleansed and purified. Emotions must be free of all negative, toxic attitudes. This is where most people fall down. I know we have cases constantly of people who are trying to develop spiritual overtones of life, who spend their lives seeking for truth and hating each other. This won't work. Any individual who expects to get anywhere in religion has got to give up hating anything or anyone. He may not want to cultivate that person. He may not feel that that person is right. But the moment he uses emotional energy negatively, he is destroying himself and not the other person. Any destructive attitude of the emotions must be corrected. Emotions must be open, constructive, idealistic, and be no more nor less than that which is recommended in the Sermon on the Mount. The very point of this is clearly revealed in Christian doctrine, but there are very few Christians that manage to make it, because there are very few people in this world, including Christian sects, that like each other. This problem of constant competition of feelings, the tremendous aggressiveness of ambitions, the determination to get back at someone, or to go on moaning through life because of a tragedy, misery, misfortune that has occurred. The person who is emotionally disturbed a large part of the time will not get any further. In fact, he won't even reach this level successfully. He won't reach it because the entire magnetic field, the various chakra centers and so forth involved in development, cannot react constructively to negative human attitudes. The individual can assume that he is going to make it anyway, and he is going to try, perhaps, and find a teacher who will help him to be enlightened without correcting these faults. But he will find in the long run that he has simply deceived himself. There is no answer to improvement except to improve. There is no way of being better than we are now except by becoming better than we are now. And if we want to be more than we are now, we must build upon a foundation of solid achievement. Otherwise, the entire problem becomes a travesty. Now, in religious organizations, we find the tendency, especially in modern times, to overlook or gloss over lightly these problems of conduct in relationship to spiritual growth. We are more or less invited to believe that if the person joins a religious organization, this does it. That if the individual gets up and claims that he is going to be a good Christian or a good Buddhist or a good Brahmin or a good Jew, that the affirmation does it. This is not true. The individual is never any better than his own conduct. He is never more advanced or more spiritual than the dignity of his attitudes toward life. Therefore, in the problem of searching for a teacher, we have to realize that our ulterior motives must be very clearly and carefully found out and corrected. Why are we looking for the teacher? Most people have very simple answers. I got a letter not long ago. The individual said, I've been miserable all my life. I'm half sick and I'm neurotic and I want a way out to something better. Well, now that's a common kind of appeal, and you respect it. It is something to respect. But the only way this individual can get what they want is to change themselves. And anyone who promises to give them enlightenment without correcting their faults is themselves deceived or unaware of the facts. How can we change a person who is resolutely determined to stay as he is? How are we going to correct the condition or the faults of a person who is perfectly willing to correct his virtues a little more, but will not for one moment change his faults? Now, faults are funny things. On a personal level, they've broken more homes probably than any other factor in history. Second place probably is religious conflict, then political conflict, then racial strife, then national misfortunes. Everywhere in the world, man looks for peace, but he expects to achieve it by overcoming his enemy. We are in it right now in a heavy political situation all over the world. We are faced with the danger of a great war to create peace. And this is what happens in nations, and it happens in the individual. We cannot be happier than we are unless we earn a happiness greater than that which we have now. We cannot get over our troubles unless we correct the causes of them. And this is an esoteric doctrine that has sent the yoga student and the Zen man into the mountains for centuries to fight this out, to come to the final conclusion that you have to be right or you will continue to suffer. Now, rightness in the case of emotions is, as you have realized, the Bodhisattva doctrine of Northern Asia is the doctrine of the love principle. Christ says to love our enemies. And now it's mostly impossible to get along with our friends, let alone our enemies. We are expected to do these things, not read about them. We are expected to look around through our own lives and say, this is a messy spot and I've got to clean it up. Or I haven't spoken to my brother in 20 years, it's might now time to get around to it. Well, so he writes his brother, and his brother doesn't answer. Well, that's too bad. But he has done what he could. He tried. He must make the first step. If the other person doesn't accept that first step, that he can't help. I made that suggestion to a man not too long ago who had a cousin who he had not spoken to for years. And I suggested write the cousin and find out. So he wrote a card. I think he wrote a birthday card. He remembered the birthday of the cousin. He got a 15-page letter back. The cousin had been waiting for years to try to make it up and didn't know how. These are the things that happened. We cannot do anything unless we try. And in the emotional level, we have to try to get away from hurting anyone. Because as we go on hurting others, we hurt ourselves the most. Now, this is where many people get into trouble. They cannot get away from a certain negative reaction to society around them. This is largely due, of course, to the condition of society. No one questions that. But this condition of society is the consequence of the individuals all feeling this way. Somewhere we have to break the impasse, and the only place any individual can break it is in himself. So we have to start in to use the emotions constructively. Emotions are to be beautified and nobled. They are to become more pure, more understanding, more generous, more forgiving. In every case, all emotional attitude should be dominated by integrities, dedications, and devotions. There should be nothing in the emotional life of the person that is a cheap compromise with principles. If he is compromising, then the problem won't get any better, and illumination remains far, far away. So the person, instead of taking lessons or trying to meditate their way out of their problems, should sit down and say to themselves, I meditate every day. Can I say honestly that every day that I meditate, I live better? Am I depending upon spending a time in affirmation or positive thinking and then going out and doing exactly what I did before? There must be no interval. The Swami Vivekananda pointed out definitely that there should never be the slightest inconsistency between meditation and its attitudes and the conduct when not in meditation. Meditation is a way of life, and a proper life is in meditation through all waking hours. Not in a sacramental way, but it's simply a kindly, gentle, well-wishing for all that lives. Emotion also has to be fought out on the plane of selfishness. In these days, selfishness has become so important that we permit it to influence and undermine our integrities. The individual feeling that he wants to do something, feeling that he wants freedom, walks out on a home. The individual feeling they want to have greater estate walk out on their family also. Everywhere the individual is thinking of himself only, what he wants to do, what he wants to be, and the magnificence of a career of his own choosing. If we watch the papers and watch the records carefully, we will see that nature itself is already stepping in to prove that this attitude is wrong. We've used it for years, and the world is in the worst conditions it's been in recorded history. The great freedoms we talk about have made us slaves to freedom. The great dominations of each other that we've talked about has produced a world of slaves. And most of all, we are the slaves of our own attitudes. So on the emotional level, it is necessary for the individual to control his own life in a friendly, loving manner, to try to do the best job he can under the circumstances, never to get the most he can for doing the least he can. The moment this happens, a strange spiritual barrier is raised which we don't recognize. We don't know about it, but it has put a block on our thinking and our understanding, and while it's there, we can't go any further. It is for this reason that in the ancient wisdom teachings, the corridors and byways of the underworld, where we are all struggling, were also beset with evil spirits and monsters and dragons and all kinds of horrible and frightful things. These frightful things are wars and pestilences and disasters and plagues. All these things, and the little private antagonisms of people that go from one generation to another, passing on a hatred the cause of which is forgotten. All this type of thing is part of the emotional life, and the emotional life should be simplified into kindness. In the Buddhist philosophy, the Lord Maitreya is the next world teacher. The word Maitreya means, or when translated, kindness. Therefore, kindness is the next great avatar that must come to redeem the world. And wherever kindness ends, it must begin with us. Kindness is something that must so dominate that all negative attitudes and negative feelings are simply given up as useless. And the person finds that in kindness and forgiveness, you know, that he will have a great sense of warmth, of integrities, of kindness, of fineness within his own nature. Otherwise, he will continue to live under the shadow of old memories, old bitterness, and this and that. Also in the emotional realm is the problem of emotionalization of our own conduct. We look back upon a life that we have lived for many years. We realize that in that life we have caused trouble and we have been troubled. We have had a difficult problem raising a family. We have had divorce or damage to our home and domestic relationships. We were left orphan or put out to adoption. All these things happened. Or perhaps we were spoiled, given everything we wanted, and brought up to believe that we live for the principle of fulfilling any appetite that we feel. This, again, is a great detriment. But in all problems, we have to look back upon the emotional background of ourselves and remember how we felt and why we felt, and say to ourselves very simply, are these old emotions still hurting us? That is really one of the bases of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. Most people who are neurotic or frustrated are in trouble largely because of their own memories. Memories that hurt. Memories that seemed unfair. Memories that made them hate their parents or their grandparents or their own children. Memories that separate people because of dismal notions and reverberations out of the past. This type of memory problem is very difficult to work with, but it has to be worked with. The only way you can get over a bad memory is to find out why it was necessary. If the individual could take the memories that he has and transmute them in terms of experience, he would find that everything that happened to him was tremendously important. And he might be grateful indeed for circumstances that he now regards as terrifying or terrible. Each thing that happens to him was an opportunity to grow. Each misfortune is an opportunity to rise to a higher level of personal integrity. Each heartache is the possibility of transforming this attitude or this emotion into a great and deep recognition of universal unity of life. Each person can take his own memories, and by understanding them correctly, he can use them to grow with rather than to allow to hurt him. Nearly always a memory that hurts is a memory of an action that we have never learned to understand, never learned to affect, and never learned to get along with. So we have these problems on the emotional plane of life. And we must come out of it with a kindly attitude, a willingness to bless regardless, and a perfect willingness to see others succeed more than we do, advance better than we are, and take life as a series of disciplines in which integrities do work out. We find time after time that the individual who has had bad times and has lived through them successfully has become fortunate in all respects. It is a case of living through it and growing with it, and not allowing oneself to turn into a dope addict or an alcoholic because of a miserable childhood. All of this is an emotional frustration. It's there, and maybe the individual in any certain case may not be able to handle it in this embodiment. But if he can handle it and doesn't do anything about it, he has no right to say that he is searching for a higher level of understanding and insight. Or if he says he is trying to, he should take into consideration that he will never make it until he changes himself. Now, beyond and above this, we have the next level, which in Jnana Yoga represents, in a sense, wisdom, the mind. Now, the mind is probably the most important weapon, instrument that we have. But it has much the quality of an atomic bomb by which it was brought into existence. The mind is an attitude of individuality. The mind separates the individual from all other individuals, at the same time that it bestows upon him the ability to recognize a possible kinship with others. The mind itself is a separating force working mostly downward into the material life. It is the reason why some people are paid 10 times what they're worth, simply because the mind has caused them to become indifferent to integrities. The mind can cheat and justify it if ambition is strong enough. Therefore, the mind is the power of the individual to compete successfully with other individuals. It is the power of a nation to compete with other nations and the instinct to do so. The mind is forever seeking and conspiring to advance the estate of the person, not the estate in terms of divine insights, but the estate in the terms of physical success. And yet the mind is not that negative an instrument, is not intended to be so used. The mind is the basis of a contemplative justification of life. The mind is the thing that will enable us to sit down quietly, see why we are wrong, how we are wrong, and what happened to people who made the same mistake from the beginning of history. The mind is a philosophical instrument. It might remind us of the fact that we can't lie today any more successfully than they lied in Egypt 3,000 years ago. And we cannot have a selfish way of life now any more than we could when the Roman Empire fell apart. The mind gives us the realization with a strong proof factor that integrities are indispensable to security. The individual who endangers the security of others is endangering his own. And the individual who assists the development of others is contributing to his own development. Because he must, in order to develop, have an environment to develop in. He must have others around him to develop with. He must have opportunities to learn, to grow, and to understand. And if he becomes isolated by his own selfishness, intolerance, aggressiveness, all these factors, he is left naked to his enemies. So the mind is something that someone may say would be a good basis upon which to discuss the problem of the teacher, what we need in the form of a proper instructor. A teacher in this case must be as he is in school. A teacher teaches arithmetic, he teaches geography, teaches history, and a little grammar, a little weak on the grammar at the moment. But the fact remains that the teacher passes along the instruction that has been accumulated out of the past. Now, this instruction is useless and worthless unless its morality is recognized. Unless instruction shows why people got into trouble and shows how they got out of it if they did. If instruction doesn't teach us to correct our own faults, develop our own virtues, and establish an integrity in life, then this instruction is worthless. And more or less, this is what is happening. The instruction teaches us now how to buy and sell stock. It teaches us how to get more money by the hour for working, if we work. And when we work, it gives us the opportunity to build a great career, which will end by having a yacht somewhere in the Bahamas. It does all these things that consequently come to be regarded as the perfect evidence of the power of mind over matter.